I'm delighted to introduce Ugo Rossi to you tonight, and even more so that he's here with us. It's an intensive 3 days or three and a half days of learning about web tech urbanism, and with him we have an inspiring expert. Ugo Rossi is associate professor at the University of Turin in Italy, and he is researching the critique of urban political economy, both in terms of economics and in terms of the contestations and critiques of that. The reason he's here tonight, though, specifically, is his expertise in the digitalization of the economy. He has closely looked at platform economies and smart city strategies. One argument he's made is about how new technology-based urban economies have given rise to novel modes of value extraction that capitalize the effective cognitive fabric of contemporary cities. Those were his words. In other words, how economic value is increasingly being generated outside of the firm, based on common work external to the firm, and then how firms try to appropriate the value generated outside of them. But he's not only looking at these new economies, these new forms of value creation, but also at how they are being challenged and what alternatives might emerge. On the former, how they're being challenged, he has, for example, analyzed how bike messengers resist their individualization and their exploitation in the platform economy by creating spaces of solidarity, and how they make use of the media attention that the platform economy is generating for their own struggles against it. And on the latter, alternatives, he is exploring whether community-based experiments or projects might provide alternatives to the profit-driven local economic development that we see everywhere. And that, of course, is what interests us very much. Those of you who were here for last night's discussion with Sibylle Bauriegel and Ulf Träger, no, we've already started to discuss how such alternatives might emerge and how they might work. So just briefly, I want to mention some of his publications, so those of you who are interested to dig in deeper can go look for them. He has many, obviously, on urban neoliberalization, on the global economic crisis, on the urban root of today's populist movement. I just want to highlight his latest monograph titled Cities in Global Capitalism, came out in 2017, 2 years ago, with Polity in their Urban Futures series. And what he does there is, first he provides a large overview, historical overview of urban globalization, and shows both how cities and capitalism have become inextricably intertwined thanks to globalization, and how this urban transformation has given rise to the new populism. And finally, I also want to draw your attention to his recent book, co-edited with Teresa Enright, called The Urban Political, Ambivalent Spaces of Late Neoliberalism. It came out in 2018 with Macmillan, Padraig Macmillan, and they and the authors there explore the political condition of the neoliberal city in terms of both emancipative possibilities and existing governmentalities. So I'm very happy you are here. We welcome you and look forward to what you have to tell us.
Thank you. Thank you for the very good introduction and the very generous words. Thanks for the organizer for inviting me to this event. I attended part of the conference at the theater, and I really admire this kind of conferences self-organized by students, something that in Italy unfortunately we don't have it yet, perhaps in the future, especially the critical thinking within geography in Germany is really something I admire. So let's go ahead in this direction. I think it's really great. In this talk, I want to elaborate on my recent work. I will provide both some more abstract conceptual reflections. I will also outline my understanding of what is the urban age at this moment, what is global urbanization that we are coping with in these times. I will also derive my reflections on a couple of empirical researches that I've been doing in the last few years. So kind of offer a combination of both my more conceptual elucubrations, my more observation of what's going on in today's urbanism, and also my empirically grounded work. And in my work, I've recently been focusing on the idea of the platform metropolis. So it's a term that there is now talks about in critical urban studies. Perhaps you are familiar with, there is ongoing research on so-called platform urbanism. I use the term slightly revised of a platform metropolis because I draw from my insights, mainly, as you will see, from the work of Hart and Negri, that's in their latest, but before that, in their Commonwealth book, they coined this idea, they put forward this idea of biopolitical metropolis. So, I think it's their conception of metropolis is very good and kind of throwing light on this socially extractive dimension of platform capitalism. So I think the metropolis has become increasingly central to the workings of platform capitalism. So my idea, my usage of this notion of platform metropolis is not to propose a new policy buzzwords, like we have already too many and we don't like them, usually most of them, like the creative city, the smart city, and the startup city, and so on. On the contrary, my idea of platform metropolis is more like intellectual constructivism. It's something that I use in order to make sense of what is this value extractive dimension of contemporary capitalism. I also try to when we do critical urban research, we have to offer some political lessons. We have to offer some political possibilities. We have to think about political possibilities arising from my research. So I'm trying to reflect over these kind of possibilities. We can go on. And I start with the historical context of my reflections. I think what we had now a decade ago was really a kind of watershed moment in the trajectory of the global economy and of the global capitalist society. That is the great economic, so-called great contraction, the financial meltdown of 2008 and the following Great Recession and so on. I think can be said, all of us know the story about the roots and the urban roots, as Lady Harvey called them, of the crisis of the late 2000s. But I think what is interesting to underline is the fact that while the previous major crisis that capitalist economies experienced in the mid-70s, that crisis led to an urban crisis. So we had urban decline, all the urban scholarship is of that time, of the late 70s and 80s, and still in the early 90s, was dealing with issues of not just industrial, but also urban crisis, urban decline. There were very large vacancy rates in the housing sector at the time, still in the 90s. What we had now, it's just the opposite. It's not been urban crisis after the economic crisis of the. Despite the fact of having urban roots because of the financialization of the mortgage sector, but we had like the more urban, more capitalist valorization of the urban after the crisis, because the economic recovery that started in the United States and in the major capitalist economies from 2010 onwards has seen a new protagonism of urban economies. And so we have also, if we look at the public policy level, we have seen proliferation of these policy catchwords, like we have seen, but it's not just discourse, but it's also there's been growing interest by multinational corporations in extracting value from urban sites. So we have seen the proliferation of smart city projects, multinational corporations investing in smart city projects. So we have seen the explosion of this high-tech urbanism, like in Berlin, of these startup incubators and all these kind of entrepreneurial clusters. We have seen, especially this is another very important phenomenon, we have seen the explosion, the rise of these corporatized, so-called sharing economy, especially phenomena like Airbnb and the short-term rental economy with its impact on the housing sector, but also Uber with its impact on the mobility within cities, or similar phenomena. Have been very important novelties, very important new additions to the capitalist valorization of urban economies. And all this has happened mainly after the years of the crisis. From 2010 to now, we have seen all these phenomena taking shape in cities, increasingly across the globe, also as I will briefly show in a while. I can use these three short quotes in order to situate myself conceptually. As I was anticipating, as I was saying, I've been fascinated by the work of Michael Hart and Tanner Negri, while being myself while having grown up, I would say, academically and intellectually within this field, with the work of critical political economists like David Harvey and Smith and so on, I'm much interested by their understanding of so-called cognitive capitalism, and also in the Commonwealth book, this definition of the metropolis, which I think can be briefly recalled. The metropolis is the site of biopolitical production because it is the space of the common, of people living together, sharing resources, communicating, exchanging goods and ideas. Biopolitical production is transforming the city, creating a new metropolitan form. Then they add in their latest book on titled Assembly, which is a very interesting and challenging book, especially in political terms. They are today the metropolis has become a site not only of not only production but also possible resistances. And it's something resistance that I'm interested in. I will get back to this issue of resistance within today's cities. Resistance meaning life forms. Surviving the violence of today's neoliberal urbanism. In a recent paper, a book chapter I co-wrote with a colleague, we interrogated this notion of multiplier effect within urban space of resistance. When resistance happens within urban space, there is a process of multiplication of resistance itself. It's a kind of ingrained value of urban space, the fact that it is capable of giving rise to multiple resistances. If we think, for instance, at the Tunisian uprising of 2010 that gave start to the Arab Spring, all it started with one individual gesture, and then it was kind of propagated across the urban path. Then I think it's also important to briefly give an overview of the global economic context in order to situate our analysis in the wider debates about the role of cities. We've been kind of overwhelmed by these accounts of the urban age. It's become a recurring motif within the wider public, within public debates, but also in the field of urban studies. The fact that we are living in an urban age, that humankind has become an urban species, and so on. These, as other scholars like Niebuhr and Christian Schmidt, have showed the limitations of this kind of demographic understanding, very empiricist understanding of the urban age. And of course, this is not just this is my perspective, similar but also in some ways different from that of Brenner and Schmidt, is the fact that yes, it's not simply a demographic process, but we are witnessing a form of urbanized capitalism. Capitalism relies increasingly on valorization, on extraction of value from urban settings. It's not my argument, it's not really a very original argument. In a way, it's all kind of debates now revolve around this idea of urbanized capitalism within mass media. And I'm particularly interested in a critique of what I call what some scholars like Jamie Beck and others call celebrity urbanologies. I call it Western urbanology. People like Florida Glaser, Moretti, they emphasize in a very apologetic way cities being innovation machines. But it is something that with different intentions we are all dealing with this concentration of economic power and this extraction of value from urban settings that has led also to growing political, as we know, political polarization between large cities and on one end and small and mid. More peripheral towns and cities, what we have now politically, with what we see in many countries, such as the so-called national populism phenomenon. If we look at the media, we have proof of this growing interest of the media for urban economies, and there is a proliferation of articles and coverage of economies that offer an urban point of view, but I won't spend too much time on that. What we observe, I think, today is what I would define a new urban, as you well know, because also of campaigns here about the Google campus and so on that are very inspiring, these new urban technology technological feats. It's all about what we receive, the message we receive from the idea of the smart city, that through a combination, a marriage between the urban and the technological, and technology, especially digital, but not only digital technology, we can solve, we can fix all our problems, we can have a better quality of living, and so on. There is a new idea of new urban entrepreneurialism especially in the with the so-called sharing economy. It's something that everyone that has a smartphone can do, and there is this phenomenon of urban tech startups, and there is this idea of urban economies acting as ecosystems, as complex business ecosystems. This idea that all cities can, in one way or another, aspire to the role of technology hubs. So even cities that were not specializing, the conventional wisdom holds. Even cities that were not specializing in the technology sector, in technology-intensive economic activities, such as, for instance, famously New York City or London or Berlin itself, they can now develop a thriving technology-led economic business sector, because it's something that the urban environments are offering, the complexity of urban ecosystems are offering this kind of fertile ground for developing this kind of economies. And what is interesting in this kind of new technology-based economies, I think this table is interesting. It's by a British real estate consultancy that shows the cities where, according to their survey, it's more convenient to invest money in the housing sector, to use the newly bought apartments, flats, for renting on through Airbnb rather than in the conventional rental sector. So they kind of compare how much money you make renting flats conventionally in the regular rental sector, and how much you would earn with the Airbnb. And what is the survey? Something like 100 cities across the world. And what is interesting is that all these top-ranked cities in their ranking are mostly cities from the global south, because their evidently their housing sector is less saturated, so they offer more opportunities for exploiting investments in the housing sector. So cities in South Africa, like Durban and Johannesburg, or Lagos in Nigeria, or Cairo and Santiago, and also in Southern Europe, and then also many cities in Eastern Europe. So all this global periphery is really the new frontier for this kind of for the expansion of technology-based capitalist economy that based on the new forms of urban, socially diffused urban entrepreneurism. All this leads to increasing attention within critical urban studies, not only critical urban studies, but in critical social sciences on rent extraction. So we were accustomed to associate the extraction of rent within urban studies on, based on ideas of Dave Harvey and Neil Schmidt on exploitation of the so-called rent gap in the housing sector. Today, in the light of the event of this called taking economy, in which taking economy is a term used by some economists and legal scholars who critically analyze the ways in which multinational or high-tech giants, so-called, they capture the economic value that is socially produced. So my idea is that multinational corporations, the new monopolies of the high-tech age, capture the economic value co-created through the, and I will provide some evidence through my research, through the interaction between socially diffuse human labor and technology, and this happens, takes place within the metropolis. So the metropolis is the offers the social ecologies that allow this kind of capture of economic value. And I will, so corporations are interested in the fact that metropolis is the place, as Hart and Hegel were defining it, as the place where people live together, where they share their knowledges, their affects, and where people communicate and so on. So the platform, now I can define eventually my notion, my understanding of the platform metropolis. Usually we associate the so-called platform revolution, if we look at the conventional definitions of the so-called platform revolution, as a system that allows consumers and producers, a very market-led conceptualization usually of the so-called platform the platform economy, where customers and sellers they meet each other. So platform becomes essential because Amazon makes it easier for sellers. And this is the conventional understanding. I think we can go beyond this very beyond this conventional understanding, looking at the ways in which today's capitalism sets in motion dynamics of extraction, not only in the literal sense, of course, in terms of material resources, but also in a deeper sense through the mechanism of valorization that involved the social fabric. And my research, I hope, will clarify this statement. So basically, I think that given to, I think what rent today is no longer kind of pathological expression of wealth appropriation, but is kind of integral to the mechanism of the platform capitalism. And because rent is extraction of value, and extraction of value happens from the metropolis, which is the space of the common. My idea is that rent-seeking, that is the characteristic of capitalist economies, can be understood as a common-seeking practice. Is briefly put. And so, basically, my question is also, having provided this this understanding, is what is the politics in these urbanized, are only with victims of these processes of rent grabbing, of this gentrification, of this basic processes of gentrification that are kind of suffocating our urban experience. I think we can look at the urban fabric as a field of confrontation between different common seekers in a way. On one hand, multinational corporations that are always committed to extract this value, but on the other hand also weaker subjects or subjects that are exploited, but they try to enact a politics of the common, as I will show. To anticipate this politics of the common, usually under conditions of late neoliberalism and processes of increasingly more violent and sometimes also authoritarian processes of urban transformation, this politics emanates from the perseverance of being, and it's a politics that is often interstitial. It happens within the interstices of urban spaces. Interstitial politics was defined by Olin Wright, who died recently, as the various kinds of processes that occur in the spaces and cracks within some dominant social structure of power. My question is, does this interstitial politics led to a politics of the common, or is it just a politics of survival? And when I say it's leading to a politics of common, I get back to my initial question, which is how we can develop what Hart and Negri define lasting institutions of the common, something that endures, something that remains, something that we can use. I anticipate that I don't have a question to this, don't have an answer to this question, to this fundamental question, but I think it's something that this lasting institutions of the common is something that we have to explore together, we have to explore through political actions. So I don't have a recipe to ready recipe for this. Now I will refer to some field exploration, some field research I've done recently in the last couple of years or 3 years maybe, in two cities basically. I've also done some other research, but these are two that I want to bring your attention to, in touring in Italy and during this year in Belgrade in Serbia. I think, of course, I live in Italy, so I also do research in my country, but I think Southern Europe has acquired a renewed prominence in politically and economically in the last decades, in the aftermath of the economic crisis of the late 2000s, and it's something that has to be underlined. Because, as you know, Southern Europe was at the center of the so-called sovereign debt crisis in the early 2010s, and then there were the great mass uprisings in the Spanish squares, the anti-austerity struggles in Greece, and then there were there was the new municipalist movement in cities across Southern Europe, but especially in Spain. Last week I attended one of these series of conferences called Fearless Cities in Belgrade that covered the Balkan region. And there have been conferences of this kind in not just in Southern Europe, but also last year was to the first that happened in North America, in New York City. So the cities have been not just hit by austerity measures in terms of budget cutbacks, but have been also reacting, and cities are places of mobilizations, and they are demanding more power, and they are also opposing this new wave of national populism or national sovereignism, and this backlash against ethnic and racial minorities and immigrants. So there is a kind of new duality between nation state and cities, and the political potential of cities now, I think, finally, for us, that we are urban scholars, it's finally really at the center. It's not just a niche in a way that has been for a long time, but it's this right to the city, and this city politics is really at the center of political debate, at least within the left, and it's something that is very important to bring to the attention here. So my first exploration is research I did in the winter of 2016-2017 there had been a protest of bikers, of these young bikers working with apps for some of these also German companies like Foodora at the time was called, now there is Deliveroo and others, and there was a protest strikes, and I decided to explore this this movement, and there is this narrative of these new jobs in the gig economy, these very precarious jobs, that is, you can become a ride with us. It's not the corporate narrative goes, it's not a proper job, but it's for fun, and it's also like this guy is the chief executive officer, is an innovator in this sector, and he says that he occasionally enjoys still, despite being very busy, doing deliveries, and he says that I do it for fitness and because it's fun. So it's a sector that has become increasingly widespread in contemporary cities, and the colorful corporate uniforms of these riders are now kind of customary presence in the landscape of our cities, and especially in Turin has been the first city in Italy where they started to organize themselves, and it's interesting that it's happened in Turin because the city has recently invested a lot in its image, the reinvention of its image in terms of urban marketing in the food sector, portraying itself, because it's a city where also the slow food idea was invented, or the region at least, or where leading commercial enterprises like Italy also started, and the Salone del Gusto and many other initiatives. So this food sector has become really an engine of the urban economy that was, as you know, previously associated with the car industry. And in my research, I looked at this. I was going with the riders using my bicycle, so it was kind of ethnography with them, and it was interesting for me because it was a post-protest moment, which the protest was kind of being more quiet at that time, but I was following what happened, and it's something that was in a very different second case study. I was looking at what happens in a post-protest environment. Usually we pay a lot of attention to eruptions of social movements, but I think we don't investigate much what happens after the protest. I think the apart from their reclaiming of better pay conditions and so on, I think these people, these bikers, engage in this struggle in order to find a sustaining environment, in order to be able to preserve in these very hard times for them, or in these very low-paid jobs, in these very precarized jobs. So I was focusing on the organized was something very interesting. They organized a self-organized tavern in public space where they were distributed beverages and small snacks during the winter. And I think this was a very interesting way of organizing their social relations. I can also briefly, 5 minutes, okay. I think the second quote is interesting because, the first, yeah, let's read this shorter. With my colleagues, we realized that we had nothing to lose. This just a temporary job, not the start of an improbable career. The pay conditions are so bad and the company's management is so arrogant that organizing a protest was an obvious response. Engaging in the struggle was a way of liberating our voices. We finally had the chance to do so. The second field research I want to report on, you can go ahead, is the one on its famous or infamous process of urban regeneration of the waterfront facing the Sava River in Belgrade, based on a partnership between the state and a foreign real estate company. So it is a kind of more conventional real estate process of urban regeneration, and there was for very kind of unprecedented popular response to this process in 2016 with demonstrations after some scandals in the construction site because of lack of authorization in demolishing some settlements there, some housing there. So there was in 2010 this movement, Nedavimo Beograd, that took to the streets with several thousands of people in Beograd, had witnessed these demonstrations for nearly 20 years from the anti-Milosevic demonstration. So it was a big thing in the city's experience. In my current research, again, I've been focusing on the post-protest environment, what happens after 2 years later. That kind of movement opposing the mega project has come down in a way for many reasons, also because of the natural life cycle of social movement. The first picture is a picture I took this last week, but I also had from my previous research visits during the winter, is a barrack created by refugees that are in the construction site of the waterfront. It's a place it's a bit hard to access it, and it's a place where some refugees go before doing the game, before departing for the border. And then the second picture is shows Syrian refugees that are looks kind of quite obvious scene. People chatting in public space in the garden, but they were as this sign, which is now not very easy to read. They were banned from those gardens because of these mega projects that has cleansed the urban space, but they have slowly reappropriated. There was a massive influx of refugees in 2015, and then they have been deported to some refugee camps, but still there is an enduring presence. These pictures want to highlight this. And then another case study, another case of resistance that I've been exploring is some in a hotel that was abandoned for commercial reasons, and that is also associated with the economic revalorization and the mega waterfront project. There are some war veterans, some military personnel, they're not war, war veterans, that about 30 families that are there and are risking eviction, and they are, despite the fact that they are not people that are accustomed to struggle because they were military personnel, but also because despite the fact that they are all in their 60s and 70s, they are also their children, but they are mostly in their 60s and 70s, they are quite vigorously resisting, and is also a very interesting way, unexpected resistance in urban space. So, almost done, and I think it's both cases, the fact of being there, the migrants, the refugees, despite all the checks, still using the gardens and making a barrack in the construction site, on the other hand, the war veterans still living in that abandoned Hotel Bristol, but also the bike riders, these precarized young people who are finding the way to organize themselves despite of not being guaranteed by labor unions. I think all these kind of resistances show that this politics of the common, this search for being in common, happens beyond the realm of conventional radical politics and conventional social movements. So it's not oftentimes it's not the usual aspects that give rise to this embryonic, this emerging politics of the common, but it's new subjects in often interstitial space, interstitial forms also. So this politics of the common is an interstitial politics of survival, of endurance, arising from the perseverance of the being, from the energy of the desire, and the desire to live, of the precarized bike riders, of the war veterans, of the refugees that want to go to the border. So I conclude with some questions. I think that these molecular practices of perseverance are like fireflies. They are not still very big lights. They are like fireflies. Lights of hope in the darkness of today's neoliberal urbanism. And so the question, the challenge is how to turn these fireflies, these small lights of hope into lasting institutions of common, how to turn them and how to use the potential they express. And how to avoid, I have added this after attending today George Agamben's lecture here in Berlin, how to avoid the temptation of messianic inactive politics of subtraction. We could be tempted by conceiving of this interstitial politics as something that is subtracting itself from capitalist exploitation, but we have to think, I think, also in terms of actively producing a new politics of the common and new institutions of the common. And I define these expression, these manifestations of the politics of the common, of these refugees that are increasing more and small in number, or of those resisting and trying not to be evicted and so on, as a residual urbanity. And I think even in a very pervasive processes like the water regeneration in Bangalore that have been researching this year, I think there is always, because of this multiplying power of the urban, is in a way always a residual urbanity that stays there and in unexpected ways. And this is why we like the urban, and the urban offer us a lot of opportunities in terms of political transformation, how to turn, and this is the challenge, all these fragmented manifestations of the political politics of the common inter dispersed but coming community, as Agamben put it in his, I think, best politically speaking, a book of 1990, The Coming Community was titled, in which there is no prefixed identity, no prefixed belonging. I think it's something that deserves a close reflection. Thank you.